Good evening. Hope everybody can hear me. Welcome to the LSE, those of you who are not from the LSE, and to those of you who are, welcome anyway. My name's Tony Travers. I'm director of the school's Greater London Group and co-director of the Cities Programme, and I'm your chairman tonight. We're here this evening for the Clifford Barclay Enterprise Lecture. This is a lecture in honour of Clifford Barclay, who was an LSE governor, born and lived in London, I'm told, by Stephen, his son, and family who are here this evening with us, and who was, as Stephen puts it, a believer in enterprise. Now, the subject of enterprise in London, we're going to hear this evening from Ricky Burdett. Ricky will be known to many of you. He is the director of the LSE Cities Programme. He was previously director of the Architecture Foundation and was a member of the government's Urban Task Force, chaired by Lord Rogers. He is currently a member of the Mayor's Architecture and Urbanism Unit. That's the Mayor of London's Architecture and Urbanism Unit, which is also chaired by Lord Rogers, and has, I think it's fair to say, very significant international experience. And though he's a friend of mine, I think I can honestly say he's very widely recognised, not only in Britain but elsewhere in the world, as an architectural commentator and guru. This evening he's going to talk to us about London, and in the tradition of architecture lectures, we're going to see a fair number of pictures of the city, many of us know, but Ricky's going to pick up on the way the city is changing and how it has developed in recent years. Ricky.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. It's very kind of you, Stephen, and other members of the family to invite me to give one of the many lectures that you have sponsored in your father's name, and I really am honored to be asked. What I'm going to try and talk about tonight is this idea of enterprise and the city, and I'm going to focus very much on the issue of London, which is here before you. But obviously, as an architect, and you can understand this, many of you in the room know this, I can't possibly speak without slides and illustrations. And it's going to be a very personal story, possibly a very biased one, a sort of journey through London, which relies more on images than it does on graphs and statistics, even though we are at the LSE. On the other hand, what I'm really trying to do in this talk is to expand the notion of enterprise, and particularly when we talk about enterprise and the city, it's not just an issue of the property market or commerce and the forces which shape a place like this, but very recently in London, it's very tangible when you're out there, there are issues to do with culture, to do with urban regeneration in the wider sense, which are actually the forces which are affecting change in the city. So enterprise is very much to me something which goes from the property market to the Tate Modern, for example, which I will talk about later. The title of my talk, Urban Transformations, really deals with these two poles. It's urban transformations both of the shape of the city, the form of the city, the streets, the buildings, and the resulting spaces in between the buildings, which are changing all the time. And in London, it's quite fascinating what's happened. It's not all wonderful, by the way. That's not what I want to say. But the other side of the coin, and very importantly, is the shape or the structure of politics, economics, and society in London, which is also changing. And I want to try and make a link, in a way, between these two issues. So what is the effect of the new mayor on London, for example? What is the effect that there is an enormous demand for maybe 750,000 new homes in this city? What is that going to do to the shape of London as we know it? And how are people going to be involved in that decision? And in talking about these two poles, the physical and the social, let's call it that, it really summarizes the big themes that the LSE Cities Programme is addressing in its teaching and research activities. So in that sense, I'm very happy to be able to talk here tonight, not just as a personal view, but representing the research interests of a small group of people here at the LSE. My core argument, if there is one, rather than just a personal journey, is that this sort of large and messy structure around the River Thames this sort of difficult to describe thing, which is London, has actually been able to respond to change in ways which is possibly more flexible because of its form, that's in a way my argument, than other cities which are more formal, more classical, like, let's say, Paris, Rome, or even parts of New York, which a number of us visited last week. And I want to stress, this is not to say that everything is fine in London. Everything is not fine in London. I just want to talk about London as a case study, as a laboratory to make this link between the physical and the social. So to do that, I really want to stand back a moment and explain the larger context through a series of images to then end up with some conclusions. Now, probably the most important aspect in terms of context that I think we need to consider. Many of you will know the slide, but I hope it's worth looking at it together again. It's a satellite view of Europe. It shows Italy down at the bottom, France, England, and Ireland. And where the lights are on is the greatest concentration of human habitation, cities or suburbs. And you can see that the southeast of England is incredibly densely built up, just as much as you can see here on this area as the Randstad in Holland. Fascinating to see that in France, except for Paris, sort of the lights are out. Scotland, Wales, Ireland, it's absolutely extraordinary how difficult the distribution of people is throughout this great continent. But this is a key issue which I hope you keep in your mind as we go through this journey, that after all, we are an island, and the issue of a very dispersed population, which is occupying a lot of land for the number of people who live here, is a big issue when it comes to growth and development. Where are all the new houses, the new offices going to go if the economy is strong and the demand as it is, as I will come to a bit later? Can we continue to develop London and develop housing in the way that we have done for the last 50 or 60 years of the century? But what we should also do, I think, to try and link the form of the city, as I say, to its economy, is remind ourselves, and this is very much the work of Tony Travers, who's done in comparing the southeast and greater London with other economies in the world, we should remind ourselves that London, which we see there in the dark bit and the white bit, which is greater London, occupies a region in the southeast of England which has an economy which is truly global. If I'm right, Tony, the economy of the southeast is larger than Switzerland, Saudi Arabia, and Denmark. We're talking about a vast region and with enormous wealth and enormous power. And therefore, the issues of growth and development are very central. But if we look into that slide that we saw before of the great concentration of people in the southeast of England and in London in particular, there's another interesting story, which is again shown by the slide. The city is actually quite dispersed. There's quite a lot of empty space, and particularly as you go east, there are a lot of unbuilt bits. There are the so-called brownfield sites, as they're known in the trade, in architecture and planning. There are sites which were mainly industrial and now are vacant. There are also wonderful parks, Hyde Park, Regent's Park, and others that you can see. But the city is incredibly generous in the ways that it's sort of stretched out, and possibly, I would argue, too much. That's what London is about. I flew only an hour and a half ago over the city to land at Heathrow, and you go on and on and on over the suburban development, mainly developed in the 30s as a result of the tube lines. So that is part of the London as we know it. But also another wonderful part that many of you know is the great estates, the great pieces of speculative development, and that word is important in terms of the theme of this lecture. Speculative development of the 18th and 19th centuries, which ended up with Eaton Square, Belgrave Square, and some of the great urban set pieces of London. These were private pieces of land owned by dukes and princes or whatever else, which over time became reconnected and have become exactly that fabric of the city which supports such a different life. But before we go back and look in more detail at some of the projects, some of the things that are there, I just want to remind ourselves of this extraordinary expansion of a city, which is London. London started 2,000 years ago, right there. You all know this, it's the city of London. Just remember that shape, because that shape keeps on coming up and is very strong today, not just as a shape in terms of its role in the economy, which many of you know in this room is of international, in fact, global strength, but also a shape which determines the growth of the city, the rest of the city around it. So you already see here not only that this is the first crossing point of the river 2,000 years ago, let me stress, but you begin to see major routes which go up to the north and to the west, which are important. Now, over time, as we move towards the 18th century, London grew. And what do you see? You begin to see the little hamlets, whether it's Hampstead, Chiswick, Greenwich. All the little dots represent exactly those clusters or urban villages as we know them, which configure London's life. If you do the same map of Paris or the same map or sequence of New York, you would not get these strong clusters, which are then linked by the major routes, which take you, as I say, north, east, south, and west, which become sort of the poles of city development. And it's in the 18th century and then in the 19th century that the city begins to expand with those great estates that we saw before, 19th century like that, and then wham, 20th century. The effect of the tube in terms of creating then the greatest and largest city in the world at the beginning of the 20th century. This is more or less what we're left with today. But what has happened is a reverse problem, and a very important problem which we tackled in the Urban Task Force, which is one of urban depopulation. So what you see here is London along the River Thames, the Isle of Dogs, all the centers that we talked about before, which give it sort of this great messiness, but this great vibrancy. But London over the last 20 years or so, or up until about 5 or 6 years ago, has been relatively dramatically losing population. From the height of around 8 million, it dropped to 6.5 million. In fact, it's now growing, and we'll look at that again. That is not as dramatic as the loss of Liverpool, which lost 35% of its population at the same time. Manchester, which lost, in some cases, 20% in its inner wards of its population. That's one house in every five. You can imagine what it feels like in living there. So the issues that one has to address in London are partly one of depopulation and degradation, but also one of this city of enormous wealth and sort of nearly global importance. What is extraordinary to me is that today, this city of 7 million people, very similar in terms of scale to New York in many points of view, still has no real plan. This is a very important point, why London does not actually have a plan. And in many times throughout its history, it's actually resisted the idea of having a plan which regulates growth in a very, very tight way, allowing the space for sort of this enterprise culture to work its way through the development process. Now, we also know that what lies behind that map is the political reality, what Tony Travers has written extensively about, the fragmented nature of London. From 1985, when Mrs. Thatcher rather cynically abolished the GLA to get rid of Ken Livingstone, little did she know, we end up with 33 boroughs, and of course there is the city, the sort of the strongest amongst equals, so to speak, right at the center. And London has developed, and in a way you could even say reached its pinnacle in terms of competitiveness at the moment with other cities, at exactly the time, from the mid-1980s onwards to now, at exactly the time that it's actually been at the height of its fragmentation. Now, I think this is an interesting issue which is worth exploring. Because Ken came back, many of you must have voted for him, otherwise he wouldn't be there, and is now responsible to try and sort of pull many of these strands together. And as Tony has said, together with the others, I'm involved in trying to focus on some areas. And one of the key decisions that he made, apart from building himself a rather nice home south of the river, some people call it a funny light bulb, the front of a Ford Fiesta, well, it doesn't matter. What is important about this rather extraordinary building is not that it's extraordinary, it's that it's on the south side of the river, very important statement to make in the year 2000, 2001, And it's actually part of a rather major commercial development. This is not a public building commissioned by a public client. It's actually bought on a rather good deal, I understand, from a developer who was very interested in having what you might even call an anchor tenant, if you could use that term, at the middle of its site. So that is one of the first important things he did, and that's where he'll be living or hanging out from a year from now with his GLA team. But the other critical thing that Livingstone has decided to do is to effectively accept one of the key recommendations of the Urban Task Force, which is that growth in London has to stop at its edges of the Green Belt. The Green Belt, as many of you know, was the great invention of Patrick Abercrombie, the great planner of the 1940s, who stopped London effectively becoming the Las Vegas continuing suburban sprawl by inventing this notion of containing growth within the Green Belt, with the creation of new towns around the edges. So what Ken Livingstone has done is immediately to reinforce that, basically saying no more development on green land. We have to build within the boundaries of the city, and as I think I've shown you, there is plenty of opportunity from some of those aerial photographs that you saw of the brownfield sites. But of course it's not easy. What one has to try and maybe avoid, difficult and controversial as it is the notion that you take up valuable green land and turn it into this. This is a very difficult issue to raise in England, a country with a culture which is very much dedicated to the countryside. But is this country, is it pseudo-country? Who's it for? What's it about? I mean, it takes some design to create an environment like this where people can't even see each other's front doors. I mean, it's a quite clever thing to do. But the issue here is that the population projections proposed by the government, and I think accepted now by London and the boroughs, is that throughout the nation, throughout the whole of England, there is to be, over the next 15 years, a growth in housing units of 3.8 million households. 3.8 million households, that's a vast amount. That's more or less the number of house units you have in London at the moment, in London within the Green Belt. In London itself, that translates into something like 750,000 units over the next 15 years. Now, these numbers sort of don't mean very much. They're just, it's very large. I think that's the key thing to remember. But then we have to consider both this issue of who is going to occupy this housing, and think back to that very first image of the satellite. Where are we going to put them in a sort of rather congested island as we are? What is interesting is that 80% of this 750,000 new households is actually for single people. Some of them are young trendies like these architects sitting in front of their own household, as you can recognize, i.e. young people living alone. England, you will know this, has the highest divorce rate in Europe, I think I'm correct in saying. So most of the traditional families require a second unit, a second flat, where divorced parents send their kids to see others. Now, this is a very important effect in terms of the housing stock you produce. It doesn't mean that those fragmented families, single-person families, require the suburban house with two or three bedrooms and a garage. The other factor which is important in terms of the demand is that people are living longer, and older people tend not to live within the core family unit as they do in other countries in Europe. And equally, and this is very relevant to the student population here, in England, young people begin to leave home earlier and need accommodation to live outside the family unit. And these pressures are actually creating the demand for growth. Now the question is, where do they go? How does the housing market respond to this demand? And how does it do it in such a way that it doesn't ruin London as we know it? Building 750,000 homes in London in the wrong way, I think, could really tip the balance as to the quality of life that we so much enjoy here. And this diagram, I think, in many ways tells an important picture. It's a diagram which shows along the River Thames in central London areas of deprivation. And basically, the darker the color, the higher the level of deprivation and poverty. And what is quite interesting here is, first of all, you remember that shape well. The color is off the scale of the city. It's so rich, you can't even give it a color. It's, of course, the richest square mile anywhere in the world, even richer than Wall Street or Tokyo by comparison. But what is intriguing is that right cheek by jowl to the city, at what, by from any point of view, is sort of the central core, you have the darker and the more deprived areas of the city. And of course, as you go east along the River Thames, in many ways that situation gets worse. The grayer areas and the light gray areas, which are the relatively wealthy ones, are instead the suburbs on the fringes of the city. Now, if you did this map, this sort of social mapping of Paris, or Milan in particular, it's exactly the reverse. The central core is better off, and the edges are poor, are literally areas of social exclusion and periphery. Here we have this condition of very rich areas, cheek by jowl, with very poor areas, which lends itself to great potential, or actually exacerbating some of the problems of social exclusion that we have right at the heart of London. Now, you saw from that map of deprivation that actually, as the river winds itself eastwards, the areas of deprivation get more and more problematic. But things are changing. They haven't changed by plan, and this is a key point I want to continue making. The Jubilee Line, as many of you will know, was not built because there was a real traffic or transport plan. Stephen Glaister, who in the audience may correct me on this, but it was really a deal between Mrs. Thatcher and Paul Reichman, the owner of Canary Wharf at that time. And as we all know, when we all use this line, it is really beginning to unleash a series of opportunities south of the river and along this important spine as you go east. But a lot of Londoners maybe are not aware still that the importance of this line is not only to link south side of the River Thames to the north side and to central London, but importantly to link up to Stratford, which is only in the year 2007 going to be the arrival point of high-speed trains. So what does this mean at the station in Stratford? What does this mean in terms of the development? Let's just stand back a moment to understand the possibilities and the difficulties of urban development, particularly in degraded areas in the east of London. An aerial view from the 60s of the Isle of Dogs. You all know that containerization of shipping effectively killed the working communities along the east bank, the east side of London, as it did in many other cities, both in England and the rest of Europe. That became the opportunity under the 80s governments to create Canary Wharf, one of the major sort of real estate property developments, which now employs 50,000 people. And there it is. It's about to be expanded. It's about to be doubled. And it is causing great pressure, and very effective pressure, I have to add, from the real estate, from the private sector, in terms of creating new transport links to the east and south. Now, what does this mean in terms of housing and in terms of issues linking physical form and social issues? These two slides, some of you will recognize, are from a wonderful book called City of Quartz by Mike Davis, which really tells a story about Los Angeles. And it tells the story of conflict through space and the negotiation of space and the different constituencies which make up Los Angeles life. And the image on the left is an extraordinary image to me. It's actually not a bad bench. It's actually quite nice. You know, it could even win a design award, maybe. It's made out of wood, that's made out of steel, it's very solid, it's easy to maintain. When you then know that it actually was commissioned by them, the Los Angeles Police Department, to make sure that vagrants couldn't actually sleep there when they were drunk at night, you begin to worry, or you begin to at least understand that there's a link between design and social exclusion in a rather obvious level. The point I'm making, and perhaps it's too simple a point, is that actually the design of big chunks of East London in housing have the opportunities of either creating more gated communities, more ghettos of rich and poor, or actually going back to that what I would call seamless link, which London is very unique at doing, of taking sort of large chunks of private development and weaving them together. And these are the sort of the big opportunities. There are many more. There's the River Thames, there's Elephant and Castle, there is the Stratford Corridor, and there is the Greenwich Peninsula, and the Dome is right over there. These are vast pieces of land, in some cases as big as the whole borough of Islington, which are being now discussed and developed. The wonderful Spanish architects, Martorell, Bohigas, and Mackey, responsible for the regeneration of the whole of the Barcelona waterfront in the 90s, are now doing, and in fact we're working with them here at the LSE Cities Program, a wonderful plan to create housing and mixed communities along the whole new area of water as it winds its way down the Lee Valley towards the Dome over there. So somewhere up here will be the station which links to Paris in sort of an hour and a half. That to me is a wonderful opportunity. Another one is in the site below the Dome. Of course, there's a big question mark as to what's going to happen to this monument. Will it be there in a year or two's time? I really don't know. But of course, there's a bus station. Underneath that, there's a wonderful tube stop designed by Will Allsop, which links it not just to Stratford up there, but also to central London and Canary Wharf along the river there. In this part of the site, right down here, is being constructed something called, and it's a terrible name, the Millennium Village. But there it is. There's the dome, and there's a view of the master plan by Richard Rogers of what is envisaged here in terms of the development of the whole site. This is a scheme done 3 or 4 years ago. The reality is going to be, I'm sure, very different, because what is being talked about is a major development which will have some commercial development, possibly even some educational element in it. But the opportunities of the site are absolutely fantastic when you think of the waterfront and everything else. A competition was held a few years ago for housing, and in fact this was won by Ralph Erskine, who's a great veteran architect from Sweden, and the housing of this Millennium Village is being built here. I'm not going to talk about it in great detail. I just want to raise this issue, and you can think of the notion and that slide of the gated community that we saw a moment ago. I just want to stress one point. There's the dome, and here is this new community. There's a sort of rather important motorway going to Dover here. There's cold winds from practically Siberia coming over there. Not particularly pleasant, but well-designed sort of new access roads at that point. And this is a very architectural trick that we sometimes use as designers in terms of drawing. You create a wonderful environment. There's another existing environment over there. When you don't know how to link the two, you put a big balloon in the middle. No? Now, again, let me stress that this is about how do you integrate a new community with its surroundings. This is a key challenge that the developers, the enterprise culture which is building this, must recognize and sort of work with. And in fact, the architect I mentioned, Ralph Erskine, has succeeded in doing this in a series of estates in Sweden. And these are first images of some of the projects we are seeing being built in the Greenwich Millennium Village. What is the link between those few slides we've seen of some of the new projects and the history of London again? And I think this dialogue is very, very important in maintaining the grain and maintaining the relationship between the enterprise culture of the past and the enterprise culture of the future. This image shows all the great estates. There's Regent's Park and there's Hyde Park to locate you. All these bits in black are the buildings surrounding wonderful open spaces. There's the Bedford Estate, Grosvenor, the Crown, etc., and then you go out. What you see here is this sort of series of investments by the private sector. In some cases, until early part of the early years of the 20th century, these remained actually closed off, not just the central gardens, but even the streets themselves where it had fences around them. But these have come down, and the connections have been made, and these are the links which very much bring London together. Notting Hill is one such example of what one calls, in the current lingo, high-density, mixed-use development. High-density because it's not just because they're taller buildings, they're about 5 to 7 stories high, but they actually have a lot of people living and, in some cases, even working in an environment which is highly desirable, with communal gardens which are safe for families and kids, but which have this model of flexibility, which I think is absolutely fundamental. I would say, and this is a contentious statement to make, that many of the new developments don't have this very simple quality that we were able to, in a way, invent here more than 150 years ago. Now, how does this fit in the development equation with the transport equation? In terms of understanding, I think, enterprise culture and the growth of a city, obviously transport is a key issue here. This wonderful image which Tony Travers lent me really tells you what sort of part of the problem is in London. You've all experienced that in one way or another. And of course what Ken Livingstone is going to do is try to address this problem by introducing road congestion charges. This is a picture, I know it's grainy and it's slightly over-grainy, but it's a picture taken a few years ago on the day of a tube strike. And the effect of sort of pollution in the air in London was extremely noticeable in terms of asthma attacks and other things. So this is the effect that the road congestion charge, or sorry, this is the area that the road congestion charge will cover and will be introduced in a few years' time, whereby you have to pay a figure of around £5 to actually cross through it. Now, if I understand it correctly, the diminution in traffic will only be in the order of around 15% to 20%. But clearly it will make the livability and use of this area probably stronger, and much of the money will be used to improve public transport. This puts enormous amount of pressure and importance on all those areas which are just outside the fringes of the red zone. What is going to therefore happen in Elephant and Castle and the perimeter areas becomes of great significance. But of course, as you take away the car, what you can do is create better public space. And one of the key themes, I think, of anyone interested in understanding the relationship between physical form and social form is the quality of public space. London does not have a high quality of public space. It has many other things. But most of our public spaces, and you've heard this said by Richard Rogers maybe 100 times, are more traffic roundabouts than they are public spaces. And this proposal, in fact, by Norman Foster, to pedestrianize part of Trafalgar Square so that you'll be able to walk from the National Gallery across the top to the center of the square is now going ahead. So there is a byproduct, a balance between the pedestrian and the car, which is a significant issue and is beginning slowly to be addressed. And I think that's where Livingstone and his different departments can have an important effect on the quality of life of Londoners. We've all seen, I hope, and if not, you must go and see, the wonderful spaces created from a car park for Inland Revenue officers to one of the most beautiful squares, I think, in London, which is Somerset House. Simple fountains, simple surface, and people use it over weekends at times and begin to use the city with children in a way that it was never done before. There's another aspect in terms of regeneration, which is education and culture, which is all too important and I think very little talked about, and in fact very too little within the sort of bloodstream of our understanding of what development is about. This is a building which won the Stirling Prize last year, and it's a library by the architect Will Allsop in Peckham, one of the most difficult areas, the sites of great social and ethnic confrontation that many of you have heard about and read about. But this library, in fact commissioned in Southwark by Fred Manson, was a very important statement in terms of the identity of the community. It completely transformed the quality of the environment both outside and within for the people who used it. Now, this is really cultural regeneration at its best and led by a strong local authority. Again, relating back to that issue and that diagram that I showed you of the political fragmentation of London. It actually has, you could say, benefits. That was not an idea that you will find in a London plan dated 1985. It was sort of expediency and pure guts on the part of the people behind it to do it. And it's transforming that area. Another enormous impact has been the effect of the lottery. Whether we like this building or not, in the middle of the Waterloo roundabout, the IMAX complex, it's better than what was there before. And it certainly makes the life of many kids much better by going there. The great roof, which has been put over very delicately by Norman Foster over the British Museum, now known as the Great Court, is a wonderful piece of architecture, no doubt. But the key point in terms of this conversation is that what it does is reinforce the fact that this great cultural building is a through route, is part of the city. You actually can walk through it from north to south and south to north, so that it becomes a great living room of London, much as the great spaces in Milan or Paris, the covered arcades, have been for so long. I think that is a very welcome development, which mustn't be forgotten in terms of helping the quality of the public life of the city. Now, let me use one small but important example to focus on this issue of cultural regeneration. There is the city of London, appropriately shown in gold. There is that dot, which many of you, together with 4.9 million other people, have visited, the Tate Modern. I think what is important about this diagram, and just to bear in mind, is that up until about a year and a half ago, for Londoners as a whole, and certainly for visitors to London, you could nearly say, and this is an exaggeration, that this part of the South Bank over here, from Borough Market to what is now the Tate and Blackfriars Bridge, was sort of off the map. It wasn't considered, certainly, to be part of central London. When you look at where it is in this photograph, it is central London. It's right in front, of course, of the city and St. Paul's. But what is in between it is this enormous gap, which is one of our greatest opportunities, the River Thames. The Tate is in that building over there, as you well know. And the argument is, how can you actually use architecture? How can you use urban design to make links, not just because you create beautiful public spaces, but to make links which change the way we use the city and, very importantly, our perception of the city. So from that, in a few years, we turn to that. And importantly, the bridge, a bit wobbly and still not open, but will be there, I'm told, with great authority in a few months' time, is this link which brings money, investment, wealth to an area around here, which for many, many years was sort of, as I say, off the perception scale of London and Londoners. The great dangers, of course, is that this creates a form of gentrification which cannot be controlled. But this is, of course, exactly where the mayor, I hope, through his policies on affordable housing to a degree, but the local authorities principally through imaginative planning rather than top-down ancient planning, can actually make a difference to how that money is spent in small projects such as the Peckham Library, good schools at the heart of the city, are the absolute key to maintaining those people who would otherwise leave for the suburbs at the heart of the city, good state schools as opposed to private schools. But of course, let's continue with this journey, a transformation of a building from a power station, the great turbine hall, into that. We can like the architecture or not. I happen to like it quite a lot. But the key thing is, this has become another one of these living rooms, another one of these places where you say, I'll meet you at 5 o'clock in the turbine hall. Everyone now knows what it is. This was not there then. And on the way there, you'll spend some money and you'll probably buy a sandwich, you will have a drink, or you will go to Stephen Barclay's fish restaurant nearby, which is, of course, the most important thing that you need to do. And so the artistic element is important, but the effect of culture on equalizing or contributing to the public life of the city is critical. So that not only do you see these wonderful views framing St. Paul's, but you will, I promise, be able to walk across and get there. When Tony Travers and I were in New York last week, we showed this image, and it was a difficult image for New Yorkers to accept at this moment. Ground Zero, which I walked through, feels extraordinarily like that. What is odd about Ground Zero is that all the buildings on the edges are practically intact, because the explosions happen so high up in the sky that most of the buildings are intact. So it actually feels like a building site. And the issues that they are discussing, the relationship between the property market, the need to provide whatever it is, 12 million square feet of space, and the public life of the city, is right at the center of the debate. And it's worth reminding ourselves that, of course, from that we move to that in London very quickly, perhaps too quickly, the Paternoster Square development from the 50s and 60s, designed by Lord Holford, as I say. But if you go back there today, it's actually not unlike that. It's all been knocked down again. And behind the hoardings, there is this proposal which will fill the site with a series of buildings. And whether we like the architecture or not, I don't think this is the issue. The important issue here is the attempt to reconnect the spaces at the ground level with the public life of the city and its surroundings. The IRA bombed this site at the heart of the city, and Swiss Re, the investment insurance company, is building this skyscraper. Now, the debate on skyscrapers is, of course, very alive today. The mayor has made it very clear that he wants to see new towers in London to respond to the global reach of the economy and the demand for new space. What is interesting architecturally, I think, in terms of this discussion, is that a building like this can be iconic, it can be beautiful, we may like it or not, but it does two important things. The way it actually connects to the ground is very, very different from the buildings of the 60s and 70s and even the 80s. It actually contributes as a building to the public connections and routes. It also is a building which is very much state of the art in terms of ecology and environmental control. In fact, you could say that in London that debate is being carried forward by engineers like Arabs and architects like Norman Foster to its absolute extreme. How do you avoid the wind effects at the ground level that tall buildings have done for many, many decades? And this is a plan just showing how the ground level of this tower will be completely permeable to the public. You'll be able to walk through and then also go up to a viewing platform above. This is either a contentious image of what London will be like, not maybe like, will be like, with that building being built to Tower 42. And the newspapers are full of the story today, these days, of the debate of the public inquiry for what is known as the Heron Tower, under debate at the moment as to whether it should get planning permission or not. I don't want to really tackle the aesthetic argument here as to whether it's right or wrong to have tall buildings. What I just want to remind ourselves is that this strong mercantile tradition has been in London and has been behind the way it's operated for the last 200-300 years, and it's very important to keep that discussion going. I want to draw, in a way, the talk to a conclusion by looking at one or two projects, and particularly the site on the south side of the river. There is the Tower of London, here is the south side, the South Bank, which is where City Hall, as Ken Livingstone has determined it should be called, is going to be located. Here is a piece of city, empty. It's a brownfield site par excellence. It is an empty piece of land. Right next to it is London Bridge City, which hundreds of thousands of commuters use either across there or across there to go and work in the city and then return to the suburbs or beyond in the evening. This is a site of extraordinary opportunity. In fact, it is right here that Europe's tallest tower is being proposed to be designed by Renzo Piano, just over the station at this point. But the question becomes, how does one develop a site like this? And I don't want to get too architectural about it, but if you look at the outline of the site again here, what the architect, again an unknown young man called Norman Foster, is proposing is a diagonal route which takes you to the egg, to the City Hall over there, with a public space in front of it. But I stressed at the beginning that this is actually a site which is owned by the developers, not unlike Canary Wharf, not unlike Broadgate. And the questions I think one has to ask at this point is a view of this complex of buildings, which will be mainly commercial, with City Hall right next to it, will a view like this be a place that people feel is theirs? Is this a place where people will go and demonstrate, where people will grieve, as people have done in Times Square in New York or Union Square? Will it be a place like Trafalgar Square, which, let us remind ourselves, a parliamentary committee asked the designers to enlarge the size of the fountains in order to diminish the number of people who could actually go there and demonstrate. So if there was ever a link between sort of physical form and design and sort of control of people, that is the best one. And I think this is an important debate to have. I think as a project, this will completely transform that area, but it runs the risk of it becoming a sort of racetrack of North London extending south rather than connecting back into the fabric. This is the work that, in fact, many of our students at the LSE Cities program do. So when you're sitting in there, when Ken is sitting in there facing the outside world, will he be able to see heads jumping up and down and banners? Is an important question. The link between politics and architecture in London, here with Tony Blair looking very young and smiling and Richard Rogers happily laughing on the right, has always been, I think, incredibly complex. But it's also very diverse and very rich, and I think that's what interests me in this discussion about London. And the political aspect also relates, I think, historically to the fact that London has never had a plan. The only time London tried to have a plan, many of you will recognize Sir Christopher Wren's proposal for the rebuilding of the city of London after the fire of 1666, was immediately shunted aside by the king, saying, no, well, the king, sorry, might have wanted it, the city fathers, more importantly, rejected it. The only other attempt at a plan, if you can call it that, which is actually quite important and has controlled development in London, is, of course, the Abercrombie Plan and the Green Belt. But in terms of sort of the micro control of the spaces of the city, I would contend that London has done rather well without this massive top-down level of control. Now, the risk is that with the enormous pressure that I've described, both for commercial development with the tall buildings that we've seen, and much more importantly with the enormous demand for housing that I've talked about, let's remember this figure of around 750,000 new homes, that instead of continuing to continue this sort of subtle balance between the public spaces in the city and their continuity, which I think has worked well for London and for Londoners to a degree over time, instead of that, what may happen is a series of clusters and gated communities or zone communities of only office developments or only well-off or only ethnically divided communities. And I think it's very much the role here of the market, of the city, of the new forces which are shaping London's development to try and keep that connection going. After all, John Summerson, one of the great historians of London, used this wonderful phrase to say that London's development, and particularly sort of the period in the 18th and 19th century, he described London as a collision of intent and circumstance, a collision of intent and circumstance, not a place which has been planned, but a place by princes and kings, but a place which actually allows these different worlds, the market, enterprise, culture, and the public center, and communities sort of come together at best. So I really want to end by reinforcing this notion that behind this messy, sprawling structure, which is an urban form which can be described and defined, there is, I think, an order. And I think that order needs to be understood and, to a degree, repeated. I also argue that, in a way, its physical form really facilitates a relationship and has a great flexibility with capitalism, which I think is very interesting to try and understand. So London can adapt to change, but I think it really runs the risk at the moment that if we don't actually work with the grain of the city, and by that I want to stress, I mean not just the physical, but also the social, that if London doesn't work with the physical and social grain of the city, it risks, I think, sort of dividing itself up again. And it must find this critical balance between the requirements of the market, in all senses I've said, and the public life of this rather extraordinary city. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ricky. We've now got about 25 minutes in which it will be possible to ask questions. When Ricky and I were discussing this before we started, we agreed on a first question, which I'm happy to say I've completely forgotten, so I'm going to ask him another one. It derives from the fact that we and the school corporately was in New York last week. New York, a city which we've seen in recent weeks is enormously powerfully governed in a top-down way by a mayor with a single city administration. Whereas London, as you've said, Ricky, and you've shown the boroughs, is incredibly fragmented, and even the arrival of the mayor arguably has made London more fragmented rather than less. Now, question, in such a system where, you know, London is very fragmented and has been a developer-led city, as has New York, I mean, how important is the fragmentation in allowing the enterprise and allowing the developers to do their thing? If London were more tightly governed and more planned, would it actually act as a disincentive to these developers who give us this?
Well, I think patently regulation limits development and investment if that regulation is heavy-handed and insensitive to some of the core issues I've tried to describe tonight. What I mean by that is that I think for this equation to be maintained, I think there should be enormous flexibility in planning. I know that's a controversial statement to make in London at the moment. But that the regulation should fix on some of the key spatial and even nearly architectural or urban design parameters which make spaces and communities and neighborhoods work. I think one can be over-prescriptive in terms of uses, for example, or issues such as density, which is a big debate, if it becomes completely fixed as a quantitative issue. For example, there is a regulation in London, that there are maximum densities for development. So if you have to build a housing development in a particular area, there's a number. What tends to happen is that developers try to build up to that number without necessarily focusing on the issues of quality. As a result of the task force, and this is part of the answer to your question, government regulation has shifted, and instead of saying there should be a maximum density, there should be a minimum density. And that effectively decisions as to whether a project for a new housing community, such as the ones we've looked at, or a new office development, is much more to do with the quality of the design of that environment, how it can adapt to changes of uses, say, on the ground floor or on the upper floors, rather than just to these rather strict notions that tend to be within planning regulation in Britain at the moment. So I guess the answer to your question is that a degree of flexibility and therefore not over-regulation is important. But I would, in a way, welcome a series of stronger, nearly qualitative issues, which may be regulations, about the quality of public space, about the nature of the spaces between the buildings, not necessarily as to whether they should be housing or whether they should be offices, because we know that London, and we've seen this all the time, the cycle in the market changes very, very rapidly. Offices which were developed in Canary Wharf now being turned into housing, very soon they'll be turned into offices again, or, you know, we don't know. But I think that ability to respond to that is very, very significant.
Okay, now, let me throw it open to you, to the floor. There are microphones, first here and then second over there. Perhaps you could broadly say who you are and, if you like to, roughly why you're here.
My name's Munira Mirza. I'm with the Institute of Ideas. And I'm really glad that you talked about the role of culture and regeneration, because I'm organising an event next Wednesday evening at the Battersea Arts Centre on that exact same issue, the role of the arts and the urban renaissance. What I was quite struck by was that you talked about how culture can aid the reduction of social exclusion. And I wondered if you felt that there was a problem in the way that the government's investing more and more money into architecture, into building arts buildings like the Tate, at Bankside, the Lowry and Salford and so on, at a time when politically and economically nobody is talking about the dynamism of the city in terms of the actual productive economy, the industries in the city. There seems to be more of an emphasis on the brand value of cities, the image and the kind of subjective feeling that we have, that residents have, at a time when housing development is actually at its lowest since 1924. And I wondered if you felt there was a contradiction with that. And the second thing I wanted to ask was whether architecture and the investment in the arts and cities was a political There was a political driver behind that, and I was struck by the image of the GLA building. Ken Livingstone's position as mayor was established on a very low electoral turnout. Do you think that the beautiful building of the GLA is enough to endear London citizens to Ken Livingstone?
It'd certainly be well worthwhile if it does.
The answer to the second question, I think, is no, and I think I've more than hinted at it by commenting on the nature of the environment within which it sits. But I think the answer to your first question about, in a way, the impact of cultural regeneration and effectively the potential for that level of investment to increase social exclusion or tension, I think, is behind your question, is partly better asked by Tony, because he was very strongly involved in doing a study on the impact of on the local economy of that part of Southwark around the Tate Modern over time, and what would actually happen, and where would that money be spent, and how would it affect local residents and the community. I'm really not particularly qualified to answer that. But I think the key point I just wanted to make is that the notion of, in a way, reconfiguring the city, which I think that project has done, allows that bit of community, which is in a way being seen as the rump of South London, has actually transformed its own perception of where they are. I mean, going from Borough Market to Blackfriars Bridge, there isn't that much which has been invested in the area except for the Tate and one or two other things. But I think there's a sense of potential there in which different communities do and have to share. I mean, Fred Manson as the... Fred Manson as then the person in charge of regeneration in London Borough of Southwark made sure that quite a lot of money was spent into improving the pavements, the parks, and some of the community facilities, which would have never been able to get that level of investment had not so much money been poured in to a number of these projects. I'm very aware of I think what you're suggesting is the potential for, let's call it, conflict arising, the larger form of gentrification whereby only tourists and art-loving people come into an area and leave at 5 o'clock having spent a bit of money and that's it. I think a lot more work needs to be done in that area, and I don't want to claim that design in and of itself makes the difference. I will never forget a story that I was told by someone who was working at the Financial Times right next to that development, who said, well, look, you know, we can build as many buildings, we can bring all our offices here, we can bring our employers, but, you know, that's going to have a limited impact in terms of what the key issue in that part of Southwark was at the time, it may well still be, which is education. She described to me the fact that she was able to organize a group of people from the FT, journalists, to go into two or three of the local schools very close to there at lunchtime between 12:30 and 1 and just read. They just sat there and read the newspaper, read a couple of paragraphs from a book and described it and talked about it. That had an enormous impact, so I understand, on the way a number of young people were sort of exposed to a culture that was probably at that point not accessible to them. So the answer to your question is certainly I'm not arguing that design and investment in buildings and architecture does the trick by itself. It needs to, and has in some cases, been balanced and sort of gone in parallel with a much more subtle sort of level of investment in the social infrastructure of an area. Otherwise, it's a serious problem.
Hello, as our architect and environmental designer, I was very interested in your diagram, which had the London map and the squiggly yellow line, which was the Jubilee connections. I think it's a fantastic reminder of exactly how the Jubilee line works. What I'm curious about is when you pointed out the fundamental nature of infrastructure creating the impetus of future growth, what are the kind of debates that the mayor, the government, are discussing about the future of infrastructure in London? Particularly Crossrail comes to mind, but I think, what else is there? It seems to be the subject matter that hasn't really opened up a discussion yet.
Well, I think that's a very important question, which is really, what is the link between transport policy or strategy in London and development policy or strategy? And I think it's fair to say, at the moment, that link is not particularly developed. One of the roles we're playing, and now wearing this GLA hat, which I think you're asking me about, with the Architecture and Urbanism Unit at the GLA, is to begin to take a number of big sites along the Thames Gateway. For example, Barking and Reach, the Barking Reach sites are in where the Ford Works are, or part of the Ford Works are in the east in Dagenham, and to begin to look at the proposal which are currently being considered there, which is sort of very nicely designed two-story cottages. This is in a part of London that, if you were to draw an area, is actually as big as Islington, that site. The proposals are for something like 10,000 houses. That sounds like a lot, but in Islington there are about 220,000 people living there. So it's and it's not bad. In some cases, it's extremely nice. The role we're trying to have there is to do a sort of double parallel work, which is, if transport provision were to be provided and public transport provision were to be provided of a certain quality, then the level of development density and the type of uses which could be supported by that could be increased. Now, this is something that I think the mayor probably can have an impact on in terms of his control of transport for London, if he has it. Some will know better than I do. But to begin to raise the issues that there are large chunks of land that, if they are connected to public transport, if, could in fact sustain or respond to the enormous need for new housing in this city at the moment, but the type of user, so to speak, would lend themselves to living in a place which is very close to a good tube station or railway station, and to then also, and this is the second part in terms of answering your question, to also consider what is the potential for all those sites above stations. Railtrack has a lot of land, it's also got a few problems. I wonder whether those problems could become opportunities, because we know from other cultures, but it's not just foreign cultures to us, such as I'm thinking of Hong Kong, which has developed very dense buildings, in some cases very tall buildings, over railway stations, literally over them, without one car parking space allowed at all. That seems an interesting model, controversial as it is. But the other sort of example I would use is Park Avenue. We forget, we were reminded while we were there the other day, that Park Avenue is what we call an air rights development. It's a piece of land built over, I think, 14 suburban tracks, where people live, work, in what is now one of the most precious pieces of real estate in the world, above railway tracks. Broadgate does that in a sort of smaller scale. So the answer to your question is that more work needs to be done on that front. In many cases, these ideas run completely contrary to the unitary development plans, which are the planning frameworks for each borough, because they were probably conceived 7 or 8 or 4 years ago, and also reflect very local interests, which may not at all sort of espouse some of these bigger ideas. But this is where I really think there's an opportunity for the mayor to play a sophisticated balancing act, which Livingston should be capable of doing.
Hello, my name is Azar Jamali and I'm an architect, urban designer. Thank you for your lecture. I would like to ask you regarding the limits and boundaries of the city. As my understanding of your lectures tonight, you are reflecting about the city on the edge of the river. London, to me, is a divided city economically, financially. The north of London is rich, south of London is poor, especially towards the southeast of London. And if we are building new blocks, urban blocks, on the river edge, we are not solving the problem that is integrated with the pattern and culture of the life in the south of London. So what is the plan for kind of remedy, you know, that problem? Thank you.
I mean, that's a very interesting question about the division of London into sort of two halves, which is intriguing because actually, if you think of that slide I showed you of the distribution of wealth and areas of deprivation, it actually isn't exactly like that. It isn't that everything to the south is dark and everything to the top is light in terms of wealth distribution. In fact, it was quite important to note that there's a sort of fringe around the suburban periphery, which is actually quite well off, the boroughs of Redwood, Wimbledon, you know, the North London, and that, in fact, the areas of greater poverty are concentrated actually very close to the city centre, on both sides. Tower Hamlets, Newham, as you go east and north, have some of the poorest wards of the whole of Europe, which includes, in terms of negative competition, say, parts of Portugal or Sicily. And that is the same in Southwark and elsewhere. I mean, so the problem, I think, is not as cleanly separated as you say. But the point of your question is nonetheless extremely valid, which is how do you deal with these issues to the south? There's another part to your question which actually has a lot to do with the last question, which is transport infrastructure. Many of you in the room will know is that the reason the south of London has been poorly served by transport infrastructure is because of the geological conditions of the land. Basically, it's the floodplain of London as you go south and east, and therefore the technology available at the time that the transport expansion happened at the beginning of the last century did not have the ability to sort of drill tunnels through the clay. It would have squashed the trains. Hence the building of viaducts, which have completely severed most of South London. As you know, just try and cross Southwark Bridge or anywhere else around there. There are the overhead. Now, new drilling techniques have allowed the Jubilee Line to be built, which I think is already a first but modest sort of step in that direction. I think part of the answer to, I mean, the real answer to your question, I have no idea how it's going to be done. All one can do is to talk about the issues. Crossrail, I think, really could deliver an enormous difference. If Crossrail is the fast, high-speed train which, as in Paris, would link West London all the way to East London. It would go from, basically allow you to go from Heathrow to Paddington to the city and possibly to Canary Wharf and then up to Stratford, possibly, or down to across the river south to areas such as Thames Mead. All these are being discussed and evaluated at the moment. I would argue that the extension of Crossrail south of the river would be a very important issue and would, I think, deliver some of those development sites, which I haven't particularly shown here, but because I don't know which ones they are. I don't know who owns them. I don't know whether there's a market there to develop them. But certainly developers who want an intelligent return on their investment will not invest high-density development which will respond to the market in areas where there isn't public transport provision or where you can't park, which is what is beginning to happen in terms of London policy.
Anybody in the balcony? I always feel when I'm in the balcony, I'm left out. Yes, two in the balcony, right.
My name is Terry, and I work at LSE. The question I want to ask is about affordable housing. Because one of the things that we're always hearing about in the papers is the London property market. Many people who even bought council houses in Elephant and Castle for $30,000 are now valued a year and a half later at $80,000. If we're talking about young people and old people who are primarily going to be needing these units of housing, is it up to the local boroughs? Is it up to the developer? Is it up to the mayor? What kind of control will be necessary in order to have housing that these people can actually afford?
Well, I would answer that very central question about affordable housing by thinking of design again. I know that might seem a bit trite. I mean, I consider it very obviously incredibly important issue which its discussion is sort of ghettoized. They're either for or against. You know. And I think there's a much, you know, spending time, as I have recently in Holland or Spain, I mean, this issue sort of, in a way, nearly doesn't exist. Why? Because developers are able to integrate and have different levels of thresholds of what constitutes social or affordable housing. What I think is interesting, again, I don't think that debate has been had yet, and this absolutely has to do, I think, also with the development community and not just the public sector, which is sort of standing there and saying you must build 50% affordable housing, and a developer says, forget it, I'm not going to touch this piece of land if I have to build half the stuff and not make a return on it. What I think is a great opportunity here is if one were to begin to think of designing environments which actually provide a complete mix of facilities. Livingston has identified key workers, nurses, firemen, policemen, as those people who are being pushed out, as you say, from the London property market. If key worker housing are people who are in that sort of stage of occupation for a relatively limited period of time, let's say between the ages of 25 and 30, then I think there is an opportunity, and there are examples in Holland and elsewhere of this, of actually having housing units which are linked to sort of shared facilities, some shared laundries, shared even eating areas. I mean, if it's like a student accommodation, I know they're not very nice, the ones occupied by LSE students. But I think that model begins to raise some extremely interesting possibilities of using some of these difficult sites close to public transport in terms of creating higher densities which provide affordable housing. I think the problem is that affordable housing tends to mean in this country housing for the poor, while in Holland, if you're an architect earning the equivalent of £20,000, you would actually qualify for a level of subsidy. If you earn less, you would qualify for more. And it's that mix and change in regulation, of which I'm not an expert, together with the sort of design issues that I've discussed, I think could help solve the problem.
Right.
Last.
I will take two questions, and then that will have to be it.
Hello. At the beginning of your lecture, you show us the map of the borough, and meaning that it's a political reality in London. Does it mean the local autonomy to the borough, or the means the decentralization to the borough? So my question is, how about your ideas about the political cooperation or the political struggle between the borough, different borough, especially for the development project?
If I've understood you correctly, you're asking me about the relationship between the boroughs and a sort of a more centralized form of government? Is that?
No, the borough, between the different borough, the cooperation or the struggle between the different borough.
Between the different boroughs, right.
Yes.
Well, I think what happened in the 90s is that some boroughs, by getting together, proved to be stronger than others. I mean, there is a grouping of people, or groups of people, and political colors, who never spoke to each other, which came under the notion of the Cross River Partnership. And if I'm right, Tory Westminster talked to soft Southwark and talked to left Lewisham. And by focusing on one physical project, which was what to do to improve the Thames in that case, actually, I think, made an enormous impact and led to many of the projects which we now admire, such as the Wobbly Bridge and the new bridge linking Hungerford Bridge also. So I think there are lessons to be learnt there. I don't think that the Livingston arrival and the Greater London Authority in any way negates that level of sort of collaboration between boroughs around certain themes to continue to happen. I think what we have to remember is that London is a vast city. Occupies twice the area of New York, even though it has the same population. And the notion that it is all governed and controlled by, I think, one entity is highly problematic. It also goes, and I may want to stress this again, totally against the grain of the way that London has developed with its sort of clusters of villages and different local authorities.
Was there one more question? There was, right? One more, and that will have to be the last one, I think.
You mentioned the 50% affordable housing legislature. And I was wanting to ask you what you, as part of Ken's dream team for the overall plan of London, were doing about well-meaning legislature, which quite often had the opposite effect to what it was intended for. How do you go about making legislative policy within the city on an overall blanket, which has the effects that you intend? What's the process?
Well, it's a great question, because I don't know the answer. I'm not an expert in policy. I mean, let's remember that... did you say the dream team?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. The dream team of the Greater London Authority's Architecture and Urbanism Unit certainly does not control housing legislation at any level. In fact, the legislation, let me stress, I said this before, is up to the local authorities. They set their own sort of policies. What I think you can do, and in a way it's linking these two questions, is that the mayor, in his forthcoming London plan, as it's called, could set down a series of very clear principles, which I would argue should be architectural and spatial, which allow these sorts of higher density mixed communities to be built. The way they are regulated and how people are allocated to them in terms of the social list, let's call it that, is really something completely outside my expertise. But certainly the two things can develop in parallel.
Right, I'm afraid that will have to be it. We've run just 3 or 4 minutes after 7:45. First, I'd like to thank Ricky Burdett for the lecture and for answering the questions afterwards. It's, as ever, interesting to see London from another angle, or parts of London from another angle, from Ricky tonight. So I'd like to thank him for doing that. I'd like to thank all of you for coming along in such large numbers and asking questions here at the end. And also, I'd like to thank the Barclay family for sponsoring the Clifford Barclay Enterprise Lecture again this year. And nothing else to do but to wish you a very good evening. Thank you very much.